This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Podcast of audio reading service volunteers reading the Journal Gazette is provided by the Allen County Public Library for the sight and print impaired and made available with the permission and cooperation of the Journal Gazette.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Nancy with
Shelley.
And for the next 2 hours, Shelley and I will be reading selections from the Monday, November 17th, Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, copyright 2025. We'll begin with news for the first hour and then take a short break. When we come back from the break, we'll read the obituaries and then a number of features from the living section. After that, we'll read from the perspective section, including letters to the editor and editorials. After editorials, we'll read the TV listings, sports, and birthday announcements. The headlines from the front page of the Monday, November 17th Journal Gazette are: aircraft carrier arrives in Caribbean. Longtime Trump fan alters her outlook. Backtracking, Trump urges release of Epstein files. Now here's Shelley with the first article.
Aircraft carrier arrives in the Caribbean. Trump says U.S. might be talking with Venezuela, but gives few details. West Palm Beach, this article from the Associated Press. President Donald Trump said Sunday that the U.S. may be having some discussions with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, a potential diplomatic avenue as U.S. further built up its military presence near the South American country with the arrival of its most advanced aircraft carrier. Trump didn't offer details about the possible discussions with Maduro, but he said Venezuela would like to talk. The development comes as the Trump administration has carried out a series of military strikes against vessels suspected of transporting drugs. The arrival of the USS Gerald R. Ford and other warships, announced by the Navy in a statement, marks a major moment in what the administration insists is a counter-drug operation, but has been seen as an escalating pressure tactic against Maduro. When asked Sunday what he meant when he said Maduro wants to talk, Trump simply said, "What does it mean? You tell me. I don't know. I'll talk to anybody," he said a few minutes later. "We'll see what happens." The Ford rounds off the largest buildup of the U.S. firepower in the region in generations. With its arrival, the Operation Southern Spear mission includes nearby dozen Navy ships and about 12,000 sailors and Marines. The carrier's arrival came as the military announced its latest deadly strike on a small boat it claims was engaged in ferrying illegal drugs. The military's Southern Command posted a video on X on Sunday showing the boat being blown up. An attack, it said, took place Saturday in international waters of the Eastern Pacific Ocean and killed 3 men. The military did not immediately respond to a request for more information. Since early September, such strikes by the U.S. in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific have now killed at least 83 people in 21 attacks. The carrier strike group, which includes squadrons of fighter jets and guided missile destroyers, transited the Anangiga Passage near the British Virgin Islands on Sunday morning, the Navy had said. Rear Admiral Paul Lazzanata, who commands the strike group, said it would bolster an already large force of American warships to protect our nation's security and prosperity against narco-terrorism in the Western Hemisphere. Admiral Alvin Halsey, the commander who oversees the Caribbean and Latin America area, said in a statement that American forces stand ready to combat the transnational threats that seek to destabilize our region. Halsey, who will retire next month after just a year on the job, said the strike group's deployment is a critical step in reinforcing our resolve to protect the security of the Western Hemisphere and the safety of the American homeland. In Trinidad and Tobago, which is only 7 miles from Venezuela at its closest point, government officials said that troops have begun training exercises with the U.S. military that will run through much of the week. Minister of Foreign Affairs Sean Sobers describes the joint exercises as the second in less than a month and said they were aimed at tackling violent crime on the island nation, which has become a stopover point for drug shipments headed to Europe and North America. The Prime Minister had been a local supporter of the U.S. military strikes. The exercises will include Marines from the 22nd Expeditionary Unit who have been stationed aboard Navy ships that have been looming off Venezuela's coast for months. Venezuela's government has described the training exercises as an act of aggression. It had no immediate comment Sunday on the arrival of the aircraft carrier. Meanwhile, Army Secretary Dan Driscoll said Sunday that U.S. troops have been training in Panama, underscoring the administration's increasing focus on Latin America. "We're reactivating our jungle school in Panama. We would be ready to act on whatever Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth needed," he told CBS Face the Nation. The administration has insisted that the buildup of American forces in the region is focused on stopping the flow of drugs into the U.S., but it has released no evidence to support the assertions that those killed in the boats were narco-terrorists. Trump has indicated military action would expand beyond strikes by sea, saying the U.S. would stop the drugs coming in by land. The U.S. has long used aircraft carriers to pressure and deter aggression by other nations because their warplanes can strike targets deep inside another country. Some experts say the Ford is ill-suited to fighting cartels, but it could be an effective instrument of intimidation for Maduro in a push to get him to step down. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the United States does not recognize Maduro, who was widely accused of stealing last year's election, as Venezuela's legitimate leader. Rubio has called Venezuela's government a transshipment organization that openly cooperates with those trafficking drugs. Rubio said in a statement released Sunday evening that the State Department intends to designate Cartel de los Solos, or Cartel of the Suns, a foreign terrorist organization. Rubio said the cartel is headed by Maduro and other high-ranking members of his government and is among those who are responsible for terrorist violence throughout our hemisphere, as well as for trafficking drugs into the United States and Europe. When the designation takes effect on November 24th, it will be a crime to provide material support to the cartel or its members. Maduro, who faces charges of narco-terrorism in the United States, has said the U.S. government is fabricating a war against him. On his Facebook page, Maduro wrote on Sunday that the Venezuelan people are ready to defend their homeland against any criminal aggression. Venezuela's government recently touted a massive mobilization of troops and civilians to defend against possible U.S. attacks. Maduro and their officials in Venezuela's Socialist Party also have been attempting rallies this weekend to back the creation of neighborhood communities that will be in charge of increasing membership in Venezuela's Socialist Party and promoting the party's policies. Trump has justified attacks on drug boats by saying the U.S. is in armed conflict with drug cartels, while claiming the boats are operated by foreign terrorist organizations. He has faced pushback from leaders in the region. The United Nations Human Rights Chief and U.S. lawmakers, including Republicans, who have pressed for more information on who is being targeted and the legal justification for the boat strikes. Senate Republicans, however, recently voted to reject legislation that would have put a check on Trump's ability to launch an attack against Venezuela without congressional authorization. Experts disagree on whether or not American warplanes may be used to strike land targets inside the Venezuela area. Either way, the 100,000-ton warship is sending a message. This is the anchor of what it means to have U.S. military power once again in Latin America, said Elizabeth Dickinson, the International Crises Group Senior Analyst for the Andes region. And it has raised a lot of anxieties in Venezuela, but also throughout the region. I think everyone is watching this with sort of bated breath to just see how willing the U.S. military is ready to use force.
Backtracking, Trump urges release of Epstein files. Associated Press article, Dateline Washington. President Donald Trump said House Republicans should vote to release the files in the Jeffrey Epstein case, a startling reversal after previously fighting the proposal as a growing number of those in his own party supported it. We have nothing to hide, and it's time to move on from this Democrat hoax perpetrated by radical left lunatics in order to deflect from the great success of the Republican Party, Trump wrote on social media late Sunday after landing at Joint Base Andrews following a weekend in Florida. Trump's statement followed a fierce fight within the GOP over the files, including an increasingly nasty split with Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who had long been one of his fiercest supporters. The president's shift is an implicit acknowledgement that supporters of the measure have enough votes to pass it in the House, although it is unclear future in the Senate. It is a rare example of Trump backtracking because of opposition within the GOP. In his return to office and in his second term as president, Trump had largely consolidated power in the Republican Party. I don't care, Trump wrote in his social media post. All I care about is that Republicans get back on point. Lawmakers who support the bill have been predicting a big win in the House this week, with a deluge of Republicans voting for it, bucking the GOP leadership and the president. In his opposition to the proposal, Trump even reached out to two of the Republican lawmakers who signed it. One, Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert, met last week with administration officials in the White House Situation Room to discuss it. The bill would force the Justice Department to release all files and communications related to Epstein, as well as any information about the investigation into his death in federal prison. Information about Epstein's victims or ongoing federal investigations would be allowed to be redacted. There could be 100 or more votes from Republicans, said Representative Thomas Massie, a Republican of Kentucky. Among the lawmakers discussing the legislation on Sunday news show appearances, I'm hoping to get a veto-proof majority on this legislation when it comes up for a vote. Massie and Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, introduced a discharge petition in July to force a vote on the bill. That is a rarely successful tool that allows a majority of members to bypass House leadership and force a floor vote. Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, had panned the discharge petition effort and sent members home early for their August recess when the GOP's legislative agenda was upended in the clamoring for an Epstein vote. Democrats also contend the seating of Representative Adelita Gravala of Democrat of Arizona was stalled to delay her becoming the 218th member to sign the petition and gain the threshold needed to force a vote. She became the 218th signature moments after taking the oath of office last week. Massie said Johnson, Trump, and others who have been critical of his efforts would be taking a big loss this week. I'm not tired of winning yet, but we are winning, Massie said. Johnson seems to expect the House will decisively back the Epstein bill. We'll just get this done and move it on. There's nothing to hide, adding that the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee has been releasing far more information than the discharge petition, their little gambit. The vote comes at a time when new documents are raising fresh questions about Epstein and his associates, including a 2019 email that Epstein wrote to a journalist that said Trump knew about the girls. The White House has accused Democrats of selectively leaking the emails to smear the Republican president. Johnson said Trump has nothing to hide from this. They're doing this to go after President Trump on this theory that he has something to do with it. He does not, Johnson said. Trump's association with Epstein is well established, and the president's name was included in records that his own Justice Department released in February as part of an effort to satisfy public interest in information from the sex trafficking investigation. Trump had never been accused of wrongdoing in connection with Epstein, and the mere inclusion of someone's name in files from the investigation does not imply otherwise. Epstein, who killed himself in jail in 2019 while awaiting trial, also had many prominent acquaintances in the political and celebrity circles besides Trump. Khanna voiced more modest expectations on the vote count than Massey. Still, Khanna said he was hoping for 40 or more Republicans to join the effort. I don't even know how involved Trump was, Khanna said. There are a lot of other people involved who have to be held accountable. Khanna also asked Trump to meet with those who were abused. Some will be at the Capitol on Tuesday for a news conference. Massey said Republican lawmakers who fear losing Trump's endorsement because of how they vote will have a mark on their record. If they vote no, that could hurt their political prospects in the long run.
Also from the front page was an image on the youth orchestra's play Psychologic Symphonic. The image includes a conductor from the Purdue Fort Wayne Music Center. There is about two musicians playing on cello with a violinist also in the background. So the conductor has a smile on his face and enjoying what he is doing. The caption reads, "Maestro, Troy Medell conducts a youth symphony orchestra during a Fort Wayne Philharmonic Youth Orchestra's production called Alfred Hitchcock's Psychedelic Symphonic on Sunday in the Hour Performance Hall at the Fort Wayne Music Center." Next, longtime Trump fan alters her outlook. Green says she'd like to see people be kind. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution. U.S. Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene has drawn headlines with bruising exchanges at the U.S. Capitol and town halls. She has a history of transphobic, racist, and xenophobic comments. She has indicated support for executing prominent Democrats. But Sunday, the Georgian Republican said she regrets that sort of rhetoric and wants to change course. She said on CNN's State of the Union that she is rethinking her approach to politics and is trying to put down the knives in politics. "I really just want to see people be kind to one another," she said. "And we need to figure out a new path forward that is focused on the American people. Because, as Americans, no matter what the side of the aisle we're on, we have far more in common than we have differences." It was this latest remarkable turn for Green, who rose to prominence as a walking symbol of the Donald Trump's MAGA movement, and is now in the middle of a messy divorce with a president that has broad implications for Georgia's midterms. It is a public split that Trump said emerged after he rejected her attempts to run for the U.S. Senate or governor in Georgia. Though she told CNN she opted out of both races on her own. While Green has long tried to distance herself from many of her early controversies, what's notable now is her attempt to distance herself from her own role in fueling negative political discourse. Over the weekend, Trump broke ties with a third-term Georgia lawmaker. He branded Green wacky as a traitor, far left, and he called her Marjorie Taylor Brown, because green grass turns brown when it begins to rot. He also openly invited a primary challenge in her deep red Northwest Georgia district. Republican State Senator Colton Moore, whose views are so extreme he was ousted from the Senate GOP caucus, and Dr. John Cohen, a neurosurgeon who lost to Green in 2020, are each considering runs. And far-right commentator Laura Loomer, a frequent Green antagonist, publicly floated moving to Georgia to challenge her. Green told CNN she was hurt by Trump's recent attacks, which came after months of escalating criticism she has aimed at the president. From his handling of the files convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein to the GOP's refusal to extend expiring health care subsidies. The most hurtful thing he said, which is absolutely untrue, is he called me a traitor, she said. And that is so extremely wrong. And those are types of words that used can radicalize people against me and put my life in danger. She said she still supports Trump and his administration, but insists she is working to change her own political style. I think America needs to come together and end all the toxic, dangerous rhetoric and divide. And I'm leading the way with my own example, and I hope that President Trump can do the same.
State senator who opposed push for redistricting victim of swatting. Associated Press. A Terre Haute lawmaker who resisted President Donald Trump's push to have Republicans redraw Indiana's congressional boundaries was the victim of a swatting call Sunday that brought Vigo County sheriff deputies to his home. The call, in which someone reported a fake emergency at the home of the Republican state Greg Good, came hours after Trump criticized him and Indiana Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray for their opposition. Because of these two politically correct type gentlemen and a few others, they could be depriving Republicans of a majority in the House, a very big deal, Trump wrote. Police received an email advising harm had been done to persons inside a home, according to a statement.
Heavy rainfalls caused 6 deaths in California. This article from the Associated Press in Los Angeles. A powerful atmospheric river had mostly moved through the California area after causing 6 deaths and dousing much of the state. But lingering thunderstorms brought the risk of mudslides in areas of Los Angeles County that were recently ravaged by wildfire. Flood advisories remain in place through Sunday afternoon for Los Angeles, Ventura, and Santa Barbara counties, where localized showers were still possible after heavy downpours on Friday and Saturday. Due to the abundant rainfall the past couple of days, it will not take as much rainfall to cause additional flooding and rock slide conditions, the National Weather Service said in a Sunday update. Authorities on Sunday were still searching for a 5-year-old girl who was swept into the ocean by 15-foot waves at a state beach in Monterey County on Friday. The girl's father, 39-year-old Yuji Hu of Calgary, Alberta, was killed while trying to save his daughter, sheriff officials said. In Sutter County, north of Sacramento, a 71-year-old man died Friday after his vehicle was swept off a flooded bridge, according to California Patrol. Off the coast of San Diego, a wooden boat believed to have been ferrying migrants toward the U.S. from Mexico capsized in stormy seas, leaving at least 4 dead and 4 hospitalized, the Coast Guard said on Friday. More than 4 inches of rain fell over the coastal area of Santa Barbara County as the storm approached Los Angeles. Parts of the Sierra Nevada area received more than a foot of snow. The Weather Service said scattered rain could continue through Tuesday in the southern part of the state.
FAA pulls restrictions, airlines to resume regular schedules, Associated Press. The Federal Aviation Administration said Sunday it was lifting all restrictions on commercial flights that were imposed at 40 major airports during the country's largest and longest government shutdown. Airlines can resume their regular flight schedules beginning today at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, the agency said. The announcement was made in a joint statement by Transportation Secretary Sean P. Duffy and FAA Administrator Brian Bedford, citing safety concerns as staffing shortages grew at air traffic control facilities during the shutdown, the FAA issued an unprecedented order to limit traffic in the skies. It has been in place since November 7th, affecting thousands of flights across the country. Affected airports included large hubs in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Atlanta. The flight cuts started at 4% and later grew to 6% before the FAA on Friday rolled the restrictions back to 3%, citing continued improvements in air traffic controller staffing since the record 43-day shutdown ended on November 12th. The number of flights canceled this weekend were at its lowest point since the order took effect and was well below the 3% cuts FAA was requiring for Saturday and Sunday. Data from aviation analytics firm Cirium showed that less than 1% of all flights were canceled this weekend. The flight tracking website FlightAware said 149 flights were cut Sunday and 315 were canceled on Saturday. The FAA statement said an agency safety team recommended the order be rescinded after detailed reviews of safety trends and the steady decline of staffing trigger events in the air traffic control facilities. The statement said that the FAA is aware of reports of noncompliance by carriers over the course of the emergency order. The agency is reviewing and assessing enforcement options. It did not elaborate. Cancellations hit their highest point on November 9th, when airlines cut more than 2,900 flights because of the FAA order, ongoing controller shortages, and severe weather in parts of the country. Conditions began to improve throughout last week as more controllers returned to work amid news that Congress was close to a deal to end the shutdown. That progress also prompted the FAA to pause plans for further rate increases. The agency had initially aimed for a 10% reduction in flights. Duffy had said worrisome safety data showed that the move was necessary to ease pressure on the aviation system and help manage worsening staffing shortages at air traffic control facilities as the shutdown entered its second month and flight disruptions began to pile up. Air traffic controllers were among the federal employees who had to work without pay throughout the shutdown. They missed two paychecks during the impasse.
Border Patrol officer revels over North Carolina arrests, from the Associated Press. A top Border Control commander touted dozens of arrests in North Carolina's largest city on Sunday as Charlotte residents reported encounters with federal immigration agents near churches, apartment complexes, and stores. The Trump administration has made the Democratic Party Democratic City of about 950,000 people, its largest target for an immigration enforcement surge. It says will combat crime despite fierce objections from local leaders and downtrending crime rates. Gregory Bovino, who led hundreds of U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents in a similar effort in Chicago, took a social media to document a few of the more than 80 arrests he said agents had made. He posted pictures of people the Trump administration commonly dubs as criminal illegal aliens, meaning people have been living in the United States without legal permission who allegedly have criminal records. That is included one of a man who allegedly had history of drunken driving without convictions. He arrested him, taking him off the streets of Charlotte so he can't continue to ignore our laws and drive intoxicated on the same roads you and your loved ones are on, Bovino wrote on X. The effort was dubbed Operation Charlotte's Web, as a play on the title of a famous children's book that isn't about North Carolina. The flurry of activity prompted fear and questions, including where detainees would be held, how long the operation would last, and what the agents' tactics were. Criticized elsewhere as aggressive and racist, would look like in North Carolina. On Saturday, at least one U.S. citizen said he was thrown to the ground and briefly detained. At Camino, a nonprofit group that offers services to Latino communities, some said they were too afraid to leave their homes to attend school, medical appointments, or work. A dental clinic the group runs had 9 cancellations on Friday, spokesperson Paulo Garcia said. Latinos love this country. They came here to escape socialism and communism, and they're hard workers and people of faith, Garcia said. They love their family, and it's just so sad to see that this community now has this target on their back. Vivino's operations in Chicago and Los Angeles triggered lawsuits over the use of force, including widespread deployment of chemical agents. Democratic leaders in both cities accuse agents of the inflaming community tensions. Federal agents fatally shot one suburban Chicago man during a traffic stop. Bovino, the head of a border patrol sector in El Centro, California, and other Trump administration officials have called their tactics appropriate for the growing threats on agents. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the CBP, did not respond to inquiries about the Charlotte arrests. Bovino spokesperson did not return a request for a comment on Sunday. By Sunday, reports of CBP activity around Charlotte are overwhelming and difficult to quantify. Greg Asutio, executive director of the community development group Charlotte East, said in an email, "The past 2 hours, we have received countless reports of CBP activity at churches, apartment complexes, and a hardware store," he said. City Council member-elect J.D. Mazura Arias said federal agents appeared to be focused on churches and apartment buildings. "Houses of worship. I mean, that's just awful," he said.
New Mexico celebrates famous women with roadside markers, school lessons. Associated Press Dateline, Santa Fe, New Mexico. On a recent field trip to view historical markers in New Mexico's capital city of Santa Fe, 7th grader Rafi Paglian noted the range of careers and contributions made by women featured on them. Paglian's favorite was Catherine Stinson Otero, a skywriter who was one of the first women to obtain a pilot's license in the U.S. After Stinson Otero contracted tuberculosis while driving ambulances in World War I, she moved to New Mexico and started a second career as a renowned architect. "She seems pretty cool," Paglian said with a smile. Introducing New Mexicans to women from the state's history is the goal of a decades-long program that has put up nearly 100 roadside markers featuring the significant contributions of women from or with ties to New Mexico. Now the New Mexico Historic Women Marker Program is branching out to create a curriculum for schools based on its research. "It's just so essential that all students, not just female students, but every student has the ability to recognize and see the significance of the people that have done so much work to create what we have," said Lisa Nordstrom, the education director and middle school teacher who took Paglian and her classmates on the field trip. The road marker effort started decades ago. Pat French, a founding member of the International Women's Forum New Mexico, a leadership and networking group, noticed in the 1980s that there were hardly any women mentioned in any of the state's historic roadside markers. In 2006, the group secured state funding to work with the New Mexico Department of Transportation to change that. Over the years, the group visited individual counties and Native American communities, asking for stories about important women in their history. The research compiled biographies of dozens of women from pre-colonial times through the Spanish and Mexican territory periods and into the time when New Mexico became a state. Now those women's stories are displayed on 6-foot signs across the state and in an online database. While some honor well-known historical figures such as American modernist painter Georgia O'Keeffe and New Mexico's first female Secretary of State Soledad Chavez de Chalon, many others feature local women whose stories have not been widely told. For example, Evelyn Vigil and Juanita Toledo are remembered for revising the Pecos Pueblo style of pottery in the 1970s, after the indigenous Pecos Pueblo population was decimated by years of disease and war by the 1890s, and the pottery techniques were lost. "This is just a sense of justice about it," said Program Director Chris Patterson. These women put all of these efforts in and made all of these contributions, and they were unrecognized, and that's just wrong. Other markers are dedicated to groups of women, such as healers and the state's female military veterans. The collection notes that the history of the state cannot be told without recognizing the conflict that came with colonization and the wars fought over the territory. They are not, however, the first women to take up arms and defend their homes and society in our region. The Veterans Online blurb notes, New Mexico is a state of culturally diverse people who have protected themselves over many centuries. For now, the group has paused creating new markers, opting to maintain the current ones and focus on the educational mission. Over 10 years ago, Nordstrom had a revelation similar to French's. There was a lack of women in the standard state history curriculum. She stumbled upon online biographies from the marker program and started teaching their stories to her seventh graders. In 2022, the New Mexico Historic Women Marker Program secured state funding to hire Nordstrom to develop a K-12 curriculum from women's biographies. We have women that wouldn't be in any textbook, Nordstrom said. The funding was renewed in 2024 with bipartisan support.
GOP shrugs off losses, says all is well under Trump. From Steve Peoples from the Associated Press, New York. Almost 2 weeks after Republicans lost badly in elections in Georgia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, many GOP leaders insist there is no problem with the party's policies, its message, or President Donald Trump's leadership. Trump says Democrats and the media are misleading voters who are concerned about high costs and the economy. Republican officials aiming to avoid another defeat in next fall's midterms are encouraging candidates to embrace the president fully and talk more about his accomplishments. Those are major takeaways from a series of private conversations, briefings, and official talking points involving major Republican decision makers across Washington, including inside the White House, after their party's losses on November 4th. Their assessments highlights the extent to which the fate of the Republican Party is tied to Trump, a term-limited president who insists the economy under his watch has never been stronger. That's even as increasing number of voters report a different reality in their lives. But with few exceptions, the Trump lieutenants who led the GOP political strategy have no desire to challenge his wishes or beliefs. Republicans are entering next year more unified behind President Trump than ever before, Republican National Committee spokesperson Kirsten Pales said. The party is fully aligned behind his American First agenda and the results he's delivering for the American people. President Trump's policies are popular, he drives. Turnout and standing with him is the strongest path to victory. Trump's approval is similar to former presidents Barack Obama, a Democrat, and George W. Bush, a Republican, at the same point in their terms. However, their parties had major losses in midterm elections. Affordability. Since the election, the White House has quietly decided to shift its message to focus more on affordability. Much of the first year of Trump's second term has been dominated by his trade wars, his crackdown on illegal immigration, and his decision to send National Guard troops into American cities and the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Trump has talked more about affordability in the days since Election Day. On Friday, he slashed tariffs on beef and other commodities that consumers say cost too much. But Trump's primary message is that the economy is better and consumer prices lower than as reported by the media. It's much the same message that Democratic President Joe Biden and his allies spent years pushing with little success. In a social media post Friday, Trump said costs are tumbling down. Affordability is a lie when used by the Democrats. It is a complete con job, Trump wrote. Thanksgiving costs are 25% lower this year than last under Crooked Joe. We are the party of affordability. A few days earlier on Fox News, he asserted, We have the greatest economy in history. Trump's numbers about the cost of Thanksgiving dinners are off. Grocery prices are 2.7% higher than they were in 2024. Economic worries were the dominant concern for voters in this month's election, according to the AP voter poll. Republican strategist Doug Hay said Trump's approach is not necessarily helpful for the Republican Party or its candidates, who already face a difficult political environment in 2026 when voters will decide the balance of power in Congress. Historically, the party occupying the White House has significant losses in non-presidential elections. Republicans need to rely on relay to voters that they understand what they're going through and that they're trying to fix it, Hay said. That can be hard to do when the president takes a non-metaphorical wrecking ball to portions of the White House, which distracts so much of Washington and the media. Candidates cannot afford to be distracted, Hay added. As we saw in the recent elections, especially in Virginia, if you're not talking about what voters are talking about, they will tune you out. Key race. The reality outside Washington suggests that not every Republican candidate shares Trump's outlook. New York Republican Elise Stefanik, a House Republican leader who began a campaign for governor last week, said there is no question about the top issue for her constituents, affordability. She also played down her party's focus on conservative cultural priorities, including transgender athletes, who was a top Republican focus in the recent Virginia governor's race. Certainly, I support women and girls' sports and protecting them. But as you see in all of our messaging, we are focused on the top issues, which every conversation with voters is about: the high taxes and spending, the unaffordability, Stefanik told the Associated Press. Stefanik also offered a nuanced perspective on Trump's leadership. She was unwilling to criticize any of the president's major policies or governing decisions. But Stefanik, who has fought for Trump's agenda as a GOP leader in Congress, shifted the focus to New York's Democratic governor when asked about the strength of Republican Party support for the president. My sense is our party is fully united behind the firing of Kathy Hochul, Stefanik said, before highlighting Trump's support from New York voters in a recent election. While Stefanik said it is important for the governor to have an effective working relationship with Trump, she declined to say whether she would support a hypothetical Trump move to send the National Guard to New York City, as he has threatened. It wouldn't need to happen if there was a Republican governor, she said. Last year, Stefanik called for the National Guard to help control pro-Palestinian protests on Columbia University. Defiance. The Republican National Committee, which serves the political arm of Trump's White House, issued a series of talking points that shrug off the recent election losses as a byproduct of Democratic voter advantage in the states where the top races played out. The talking points, obtained by the Associated Press, ignore Republican losses in Georgia and Pennsylvania. They also overstate Trump's political strength, claiming that he is more popular than Obama and Bush were at the same time in their tenures. An AP polling analyst finds that Trump's approval is not higher than Obama or Bush at a similar point in their second terms. Trump's approval at 36% in a November poll by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research is slightly higher than it was at this point in his first term. Both Obama and Bush have approval ratings that were in the low 40s at this point in their second terms, according to a Gallup polling, which is similar to where Trump landed in Gallup's latest approval poll in October.
And now for news briefs around our nation and the world. Official contends Iran not enriching uranium. Dateline Tehran, Iran. Iran's foreign minister said Sunday that Tehran is no longer enriching uranium at any site in the country, trying to signal to the West that it remains open to potential negotiations over its atomic program. Answering a question from the Associated Press journalist visiting Iran, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi offered the most direct response yet from the Iranian government regarding its nuclear program after Israel and the United States bombing of its enrichment sites in June during a 12-day war. There is no undeclared nuclear enrichment in Iran. All of our facilities are under the safeguards and monitoring of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Araghchi said. There is no enrichment right now because our facilities, our enrichment facilities, have been attacked. 980 million Mega Millions jackpot won. A Mega Millions player in Georgia won the 980 million jackpot Friday, overcoming abysmal odds to win the huge prize. The numbers selected were 1, 8, 11, 12, and 57, with the gold Mega Ball 7. The winner overcame Mega Millions' astronomical odds of 1 in 290.5 million by matching all six numbers. The next drawing will be on Tuesday. A winner can choose an annuity or the cash option. A one-time lump sum payment of $452.2 million before taxes. If there are multiple jackpot winners, the prize is shared. Britain gets tough on asylum seekers. The British government plans to tighten its asylum system in a series of sweeping changes modeled after Denmark that aims to reduce immigration and quell the political storm over migrants making dangerous English Channel crossings to enter the country without authorization. The policy changes will be announced by Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood today in the House of Commons. Auction of Holocaust artifacts canceled. Poland's foreign minister said Sunday that an offensive auction of Holocaust artifacts has been canceled in Germany, relaying information from its German counterpart following complaints from Holocaust survivors. Radoslaw Sikorski made the comments on X, saying he and the German foreign minister Johann Wadefol agreed that such a scandal must be prevented. Earlier, a Holocaust survivors group called the German auction house Felsmann to cancel today's sale. Chile to have runoff for presidency. The communist candidate of Chile's center-left government, Jeanette Jara, and a hard-right veteran politician, José Antonio Kast, will vie for the country's presidency in a runoff vote next month. After neither gained a winning margin in a polarized election Sunday, the government said. With nearly 80% of the vote counted and results still trickling in, Chile's left-wing president, Gabriel Boric, recognized Jara and Kast as the front-runners headed to the second round of elections scheduled for December 14th. And finally, bridge collapse kills at least 32 in Africa. A bridge at a copper and cobalt mine in southeastern Congo collapsed Saturday due to overcrowding, killing at least 32 people, a regional government official said Sunday. A report by the government agency Sunday said the gunfire from soldiers at the site sparked panic among the miners, who rushed to the bridge, resulting in the fall that left them piled on top of each other, causing the deaths and injuries. While Mayande put the death toll at least 32, the report said that at least 40 people had lost their lives.
Zelensky says Ukraine is working on a prisoner exchange with Russia, from the Associated Press. Kiev, Ukraine. Ukraine is working to resume prisoner exchange with Russia that could bring home 1,200 Ukrainian prisoners, President Volodymyr Zelensky said Sunday, a day after his national security chief announced progress in negotiations. We are counting on the resumption of POW exchanges, Zelensky wrote on X. Many meetings, negotiations, and calls are currently taking place to ensure this. Rustem Yuremov, Secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, said Saturday he held consultations mediated by Turkey and the United Arab Emirates on resuming exchanges. He said the parties agreed to activate prisoner exchange agreements brokered in Istanbul to release 1,200 Ukrainians. Moscow did not immediately comment. The Istanbul agreements refer to prisoner exchange protocols established with a Turkish mediation in 2022 that set rules for large coordinated swaps. Since then, Russia and Ukraine have traded thousands of prisoners through exchanges and have been sporadic. Yamarov said technical consultations would be held to soon finalize procedural and organizational details, expressing hope that returning Ukrainians could celebrate the New Year and Christmas holidays at home, at the family table, and next to their relatives. Elsewhere, a ceasefire in Ukraine is unlikely before the spring, and European allies need to keep an eye on support despite a corruption scandal that has engulfed Kiev, President Alexander Stubb of Finland told the Associated Press. Europe, meanwhile, will require sisu, a Finnish word for meaning endurance, resilience, and grit, to get through the winter months, he said, as Russia continues its hybrid attacks and information war across the continent. Stubb also needs that quantity as one of also needs that quantity is one of the key European interlocutors between the United States President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In other documents, energy infrastructure was damaged by Russian drone strikes overnight into Sunday in Ukraine's Odessa region. Ukraine's State Emergency Service said the solar power plant was among the damaged sites. Ukraine is desperately trying to fend off relentless Russian aerial attacks that have brought rolling blackouts across Ukraine on the brink of winter. Combined missile and drone strikes on the power grid have coincided with Ukraine's efforts to hold back a Russian battlefield push aimed at capturing eastern stronghold of Pokrovsk. Russia fired a total of 176 drones and one missile overnight, Ukraine's Air Force said Sunday, adding that Ukrainian forces shot down or neutralized 139 drones. On the front line, Russia's Defense Ministry said Sunday that its forces had taken two settlements in Ukraine's southern Zaporizhia region.
Well, that concludes the news from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette for Monday, November 17th. We will now take a short break and return with obituaries and features from the living section.